You know, I just think there's a psyop in our society where you have to have health insurance. You know, and I would just say, like, you don't need health insurance. The vast majority of the population, you do not need health insurance. There is a different way.
You know, our screens are killing us and our sedentary lifestyles that to some degree are just a part of, you know, the flow of most people's days, sitting in front of a computer, and like they can't escape that hamster wheel.
If we could incentivize physical activity, incentivize eating the right food, I think that would cure our system, even within kind of the broken health insurance space.
Nothing changes fundamentally because the government says this is going to change. What matters is I get to decide what I feed my children.
For every doctor, there's somewhere between 2 and 3 billing people behind the scenes that are needed to actually get that doctor paid. We're here to help you.
Yeah. The famous words of Ronald Reagan. Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Appreciate you tuning in. Today on the show, we have Andy Schoonover. He is CEO of Proud Health, which is an alternative to traditional health insurance. We talk about the traditional health insurance industry, why it's such a scam, how Proud Health is different, how Bitcoin fixes a lot of the problems that we see nowadays in our healthcare system. I think you're going to love this episode. I had an absolute blast chatting with Andy. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Andy here with me. Andy, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah. Hey, let's jump right in. We're going to get to Bitcoin and its role in, you know, what I believe to be a very promising future of healthcare, health insurance. But I think we need to start at the beginning because
I'm coming to you from Bitcoin Commons in Austin. So,
I love it. I love it. What an appropriate day for a recording.
Exactly.
Let's talk, and this is a rabbit hole that I've just sort of recently gone down. I told you before we started recording, I'm a recent client of Crowd Health, and I haven't had the opportunity to use the service, which I think is probably a good thing.
That's a good thing. Yeah.
It means my family's healthy, but let's just start at the beginning. Why don't you explain what is broken about our traditional healthcare system, how health insurance works, maybe, and take as long as you need with this answer, because I think it's important that people really understand how it works, you know, claim denials, all of those sorts of things.
Sure.
And then I think everything else we talk about will make a lot more sense.
Yeah, I'll give you some context for Crowd Health, and I'll get into, you know, some of the brokenness. You know, this is my second healthcare company, and I, you know, swore that I was never going to do another one just because it's, you know, so incredibly broken and bureaucratic and regulated and all these things. And So I sold my previous company and I came off of that. And since, you know, a lot of us get health insurance through my employer, I didn't have an employer anymore. So I had to go find another alternative. So I went to healthcare.gov, which is just a marketplace set under the Affordable Care Act that gives people an opportunity to buy health insurance directly, you know, off of this marketplace that's run by the government or the state departments, depending upon what state you live in. So I went on that and got a plan. It was about, I think it was $1,100 or $1,200 for me, my wife, and my two girls. And I kind of joke it worked until I had to use it. My little one, who's one at the time, was having a recurring ear infection. So we went to the pediatrician. She's like, oh yeah, she's definitely got some issues. You know, in essence, what's happening is with her ear infections, all this fluid builds up in her eardrums. It has no place to go. And so ultimately what it did is it popped her eardrum. And as you can probably imagine with a 1-year-old, sounds like you have a family. A 1-year-old with a popped eardrum is not a fun thing to deal with. But in essence, you know, over time, if that keeps happening, scar tissue builds up and it impacts her long-term hearing. And so we went to the ear, nose, and throat doctor. Like, yeah, she has to get tubes in her ears. And in essence, what they do, they stick a little plastic tube in her ear so all that fluid can drain out so it doesn't bust her eardrums. And so we went and did that. Went in network. My doctor got a pre-authorization to do it. We got out of it. And a few weeks later, we got the bill in the mail. It was $8,000. You know, it was a 15-minute procedure. And I was like, $8,000 for 15 minutes is just absolutely nuts. But, you know, I have health insurance. Like, that's the whole point of this. And so, unfortunately, I got a note, snail mail, a few weeks after that that said it was medically unnecessary. And so the health insurance plan wasn't going to pay for it. And we went through 2 rounds of appeals and they still were like, nope, you know, we're not paying for it. And so I had to stroke an $8,000 check for that for that procedure. As you can probably imagine, I was pretty pissed. So I called my health insurance plan. I said, I quit. You know, if you guys aren't going to pay for something that's so clearly medically necessary, then I'm just not going to do this anymore. And so we quit. I became uninsured. This was in the end of 2019 or the beginning of 2020. Actually, when it all went down, it was the middle of 2020 after all the appeals and all this kind of stuff. I became uninsured, and my wife kind of looked at me and was like, all right, so what do we do now? You know, we're all conditioned just to think that we have to have health insurance. And I was like, no, we're going to figure out how to do this without having health insurance. And so I, you know, learned over time, over a couple year period, that, you know, I could have negotiated that bill down from 8,000 to probably 2,000. I had a bunch of ear, nose, and throat doctors reach out to me on Twitter when I put this story up that says, oh yeah, we do these in our office for, I think it was like $1,500 or $1,700. And I'm just like, what the hell am I doing? And so in essence, I learned that we could actually shop for healthcare services for significantly less than what these health insurance plans are paying. And so, and ultimately I built a set of tools that I was using for my family. And I was like, man, maybe other people would be interested in this too. And so it kind of culminated in me founding Crowd Health, you know, back in 2021. And, you know, as I was doing research on this, what I found is that, you know, I wasn't the only one. About, you know, one in six bills are denied by health insurance plans. And, you know, mine, unfortunately, was a fairly large one. And if you kind of look at people and how much money they have sitting in the bank, most people don't have $8,000 sitting in the bank to pay for something that, you know, is pretty common. And so, you know, something like 200,000 families are going bankrupt every year as a result of these denied bills or these huge deductibles that they have to pay before the health insurance plan will pick anything up. And so I found that there was a need for an alternative. But, you know, ultimately, when you ask the question, what's wrong with our health insurance system or our healthcare system in general, it's you know, people are like, wow, it's so complex. And my argument would be it's not that complex. And in fact, it's pretty easy to understand, especially for Bitcoiners who understand incentives. You know, you have the buyer of healthcare, which is health insurance, and they actually have an incentive to see bills go up over time. And so let me explain that real quick, just using, you know, easy math. You know, if my premium for my family is $1,000, then the maximum that the health insurance plan can use for the administrative costs and profit is 15% of that, so $150. And so these are for-profit organizations. And so, you know, how do they, you know, grow their revenue by 10% their profit by 10%? So from $150 to $165. Well, that means your premiums have to go up from $1,000 to $1,100. So they make more money as premiums go up over time. Or said another way, they have an incentive to see prices rise over time. So that's the buyer of healthcare. The seller of healthcare are big hospital systems. And so clearly they have, you know, they're selling a service. They want that service price to go up over time as well. And so in essence, what you have is the buyer of healthcare and the seller of healthcare both wanting the price to go up, and therefore the price goes up. You know, it doesn't take, you know, Saifedean type of economics to understand when the buyer and seller want something to go up, the price goes up. And so that's ultimately, you know, the problem that we have with healthcare is just misaligned, perverse incentives. You know, it's in economics, they call it a principal agent problem, where the health insurance plan is our agent. We are paying them to go and find us the best rates for these healthcare services and to get them paid when we have a big health event. But in actually their incentive is to see prices go up and to deny our bills so that they can maximize their profit in the year. So it's, you know, it's a long-winded way of saying that the incentives are just completely perverse within healthcare. There are no market forces that are driving down these costs. And so we have kind of a runaway system that, as we've seen, has resulted in, you know, incredibly high, you know, healthcare costs.
Would the incentives be hypothetically, and I obviously much prefer what you all are doing versus this system, but like, would the incentives be changed if these weren't large, publicly traded, for-profit institutions? that, you know, need to go to their shareholders and show that we're making more this year than we had last year, and we anticipate, you know, future earnings to be higher. Like, is there some sort of redemptive opportunity if things were just to be totally shaken up, or are there still other incentives that are misaligned? You know, obviously, like the obvious one, I think, being the more sick you are, the more you're going to use these services. Totally. I mean, that's one unavoidable, I think, challenge in healthcare. But is there something like that you could dream up that you're like, if we shifted our attention or our priorities or our incentives in this area, we might see a positive result from that? Or is it just, we got to blow it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to blow it up. I don't think there's any kind of iterative type of improvements that we can make to substantially change the system the way that it's currently structured. I mean, I think you in essence have to blow it up. Well, with that said, I mean, I think there are, you know, ways to incentivize people to be healthier. I mean, we've got something like 70% of people entering into the Medicare age, which is 65, with a chronic disease. We have 88% of our population that are metabolically unhealthy. And so, you know, if we could eat better, you know, if we could put food in our body that actually nourishes us as opposed to destroys our body, that would be one way. I don't know how do you incentivize that. But that would be, you know, a way to cure the system, if you would. So that was the only thing. And clearly, you know, getting out and moving your body and exercising, how do you incentivize those two things? But if we could incentivize physical activity, incentivize eating the right food, I think that would cure our system, even within kind of the broken health insurance space. I just don't know how to do that in an effective way. You know, I think a lot of these health insurance plans are saying, well, if you, you know, take 5,000 steps a day all month, you know, we'll give you a $30, you know, rebate or something. And I just don't see $30 really moving the needle for people to actually go out there and do it. I mean, these systems have been in place for a long, long time, and they haven't impacted the numbers at all. So, yeah, I mean, if we could figure out food and physical activity, I think that would go a long, long way. I just don't know how you do that within our existing system.
Yeah, and too, I mean, there are more sort of insidious variables at play here too. Like I've started to go down the rabbit hole of light exposure. Not sure if you're familiar with Dr. Jack Cruz, but I mean, he talks about, like, you know, our screens are killing us and our sedentary lifestyles that to some degree are just a part of, you know, the flow of most people's days, sitting in front of a computer, and like they can't escape that hamster wheel as easily as they could maybe change their diet.
Yeah,
I'm curious, do you think what does Bitcoin fix? I can think of a dozen things that I think trend us in a better direction, but is there something fundamental about the system as it is today that a Bitcoin, like, and you can think hypothetically about like a Bitcoin standard or just more people adopting Bitcoin? Because I found out about you, I think, because of Saifedean. I think Saifedean had you on the show and started listening. It took me a long time to come around to this is, I think what I've become is so anti everything establishment that, yeah, I kind of jumped into crowd health without having a very full understanding. I was done with like, we had a couple of things come up with health insurance, and I was just sort of done. But I guess back to my question after that ramble, what does Bitcoin fix as it relates to health insurance, the healthcare industry, or the sick care industry, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting because this is one of those questions that I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer, because I don't really consider myself a philosopher, you know, much like, you know, and I'm not nowhere clear to Saifedean and, you know, some of the other Bitcoiners out there who have much better perspectives on this. But I don't know about you, but the people that I meet within the Bitcoin community just do life differently. I think it's the high time preference versus the low time preference mentality of Bitcoiners that people who weren't in Bitcoin and then get into Bitcoin start to really understand. And I don't know the kind of the ultimate reason for that, other than you have a community of people who are all kind of contrarians in the way that we think. And by being contrarian, you go against some of the cultural norms of eating garbage, being sedentary, buying, you know, luxury goods, you know, all the time with your fiat money. And so I think it's this fiat mentality that people have gotten into, that the government will take care of us or a mega corporation will take care of us. And I think we need to get back to this. No. I'm personally responsible. I take individual sovereignty, over my own life. And I think that then incentivizes people just by this internal motivation that gets people to act in more responsible ways. So again, I don't know what the reason is for that, but I'll tell you that the Bitcoiners within our community are much better buyers of healthcare than the non-Bitcoiners, because I think they understand the impact of their purchases. And so, you know, I don't know what it is about Bitcoiners, man, but, you know, if the United States was, you know, 350 million Bitcoiners, I think we would be looking at a very different kind of financial situation, a very different healthcare situation than what we currently have. So I don't know the right answer to that question. I think it's a question for the ages, that if we can get people to think like Bitcoiners, I think it would change a lot in this country.
Yeah. I mean, much like my vote for CrowdHealth was is much of a vote against sort of the traditional system. I think, I don't eat junk food anymore. Like I just, and the reason isn't because I don't enjoy it or I don't think I could get away with it from time to time. But first of all, I've got a major sweet tooth. And so I know if I go down that it's never going to end.
Me too.
But second, I think it's just like it's sort of a stick it to the man mentality. It's like, I know that I'm letting, you know, these large food companies win when I consume their product. And I went from feeling sort of that felt benign to it felt like, an absolute abuse of my personal beliefs. And I think that my curiosity, though, is I think as the sort of innovators and early adopters of Bitcoin, we tend to be like a disagreeable bunch. What I don't know is if Bitcoin is going to change or alter the incentives for like the next wave of the early majority and the late majority of adopters, you know, or if they're just going to sort of more passively use it as money because it's going up in price or whatever, but without maybe doing the hard work that many of us before have done to understand how it should change your incentives and lowering time preference and all of those good things. I think you're right. There is no obvious answer because it's human action and play, and it's hard to get a read as to what people are going to do.
I think it is a long game. I mean, it's a long game. I think that people, if they get into Bitcoin, they over time, and I'm not saying it's, you know, 6 months or a year, I think it's probably a decade, you know, start to take on that Bitcoin mentality, which is ultimately that we don't need to rely upon megacorps or the government to take care of us. We can, you know, live a more fulfilling, thriving life by taking on personal responsibility. And that's not something that takes a year. It takes probably a generation, you know?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that you said kind of reminded me of, you know, one of the things that I'm really trying to like drive home to people is that, again, back to the time preference, like the things we do in our 30s, 40s, and 50s are impacting how we live life in our 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I think it's that low time preference view of life, which is, you know, kind of countercultural and counter to what we inherently feel as human beings, which is just, acquire. that is just hard to break that. But I think ultimately that leads to a life on kind of a hedonic treadmill where we try to get better, more and more and more and more and more, as opposed to like, no. Like instead of eating the cookies today, why don't we think about what all these, you know, cookies every single day are going to do when we're, you know, 80 years old and we have to live the last 5 years of our life or whatever in a nursing home because we have, you know, a major chronic disease. I think one of my missions at CrowdHealth is, I say this, because I truly mean it, and I've seen parents and grandparents and things go through things, but like, I really want our CrowdHealth members to be the most healthy members going into the, you know, the Medicare type of population. And I want them to be, you know, 80 years old playing wiffle ball in the backyard with their grandkids. Like, that to me is a thriving life. And that to me is more important than eating the Girl Scout cookies, you know, that are sitting in the refrigerator. And so I think people, if they can look out 20 or 30 years, as opposed to looking out 2 or 3 days, I think is really ultimately where we need to be as a society. And I think, you know, Bitcoin for sure inspires that. And again, I don't know why, but it just does. I mean, ever since I became a Bitcoiner, my view on my health, my view on what I do with my money, my view on how I can look at my faith, like all of these things like have kind of changed as a result of just understanding the low time preference benefits. And you know, that's a generational shift. I hope it's our generation that begins that.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think too, one of the things we're talking about here is we're sort of speculating on in the short term as individuals adopt Bitcoin. But I think that's a very different conversation from long term if the world is even large nation states are operating on a Bitcoin standard. I think it becomes much more apparent how Bitcoin fixes a lot of these things, yeah. Because there is no backstop. You can't print more, right? So like a lot of the handouts that people come to expect and the personal responsibility that they're able to evade goes away. I mean, you can no longer hide from that because you can't print more Bitcoin. And so, I think it needs to, my hope is that time comes soon. I recognize, the need for patience, but also it could be a messy unwinding if it happens too fast. Hopefully we just sort of find a nice segue into a bright orange future, coming years or decades.
You know what? I think we've really been kind of conditioned over the last 50 years to, instead of having self-reliance, to rely on, you know, these big entities to take care of us. I think it's kind of infiltrating just our daily lives. I kind of take the example, and I think it's right, but you know, back when I'm 45, so I'm a little bit maybe older than the typical Bitcoiner. But, when somebody moved into your neighborhood, you know, back in the day, what would you do? You'd go over and introduce yourselves and you'd probably bring them cookies, which is probably not the best thing. But it's this like, I'm, you know, welcome to the neighborhood. And I feel like society has shifted to be more like, you know, what did this person pay for their house? Because that's more indicative of what my house is worth, you know, as opposed to like welcoming people into the neighborhood. And I say that because I think that this sense of community has kind of broken. I think that is because we no longer are kind of responsible for our neighbor. It's like the government, health insurance, whatever has stepped in between and said, no, you don't have to take care of people in your community. You don't have to help. You don't have to be generous. You know, let us do it. You know, and so we're centralizing generosity in essence, you know, and that is being done through taxes. You know, it's we're sending something to a central authority. The central authority then is dictating, you know, what these people get, as opposed to like if somebody's on the street corner and they're in my community, like, me as a community member, I feel like I have some responsibility to help that person. Whereas in our current day, focus on let the government do it. You know, you drive by that person and you say, well, you know, why aren't they getting government help? Why aren't they getting SNAP? Why aren't they going to the shelter? Why aren't they doing those types of things? As opposed to being like, no, like we as a community have an obligation to help somebody who's having a really tough time. And I know that's kind of countercultural to like, or counterintuitive when we've talked about like a lot of personal responsibility, but I think there's a community aspect of this too, that is just really powerful, very needed. And I think is beautifully shown within the Bitcoin community. I mean, I don't know of any community that I've been a part of where the Bitcoin community kind of rallies around each other and, you know, is, you know, helps each other out. And so there's just a tribal nature to this that I think is inherent, given we all come from tribes, you know, back in the day, that I think the Bitcoin community is showing. So I don't know. Like I said, I'm not a philosopher. I don't know. You know, I'm not an anthropologist. But I do believe there's something around this, like unwinding of community and reliance upon centralized decision makers that have led to a fall in ultimately personal responsibility. And you know, I think we need to start stripping some of those things, you know, stripping some of those things away. I mean, we're trying to do it on the health insurance side where, hey, you don't need health insurance. Instead of like relying upon a centralized authority to help out these people, why don't we have a community of almost 10,000 people who are willing to fund each other's healthcare expenses. And many, many, many of those are Bitcoiners, you know? So we have people all the time being like, we had a guy who had colon cancer in Dallas, and he's like, crazy story. He went in for ER for kidney stones. And as he was in there and they're doing the scans, they're like, man, you got something on your colon. You need to go get a colonoscopy. He went to got a colonoscopy. He found out he had, I think it was stage 2 colon cancer. And I kind of joke, he's the only guy on the planet that is excited about having gotten kidney stones, right? Because that it probably would have killed him if he didn't get those kidney stones. But the moral of the story is like, he actually reached out to us and was like, look, you know, I want the best doctors available, but can you help me negotiate these rates? Because I don't want to screw the community. You know, I don't want to overburden the community by my health issue. And that is so countercultural. And only when you get into a community of people who have a shared worldview, do you care about them in addition to caring about yourself, because you have this just culture of like, it's about me, 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 me. Whereas I think we're building a community of people who are like, yeah, it is about you and getting your bills paid, but it's also about the community, because if the community does well, then you're actually paying lower for your healthcare costs than if we were just to go out and spend on whatever we need. I mean, the problem with health insurance is you don't ultimately pay for it. The health insurance company pays for it, right? And so there's just no desire at all to pay attention to prices or utilization or any of these things. And so, you know, in essence, I kind of say that, you know, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And so within the health insurance space, you are the product. People are making money off of you. And so that's the dynamic we're trying to change at Crowd Health. And, you know, so far it's been, you know, working beautifully.
Man, so much we could unpack there. And I couldn't agree more. And we've seen, you know, what you describe as our community helping one another. We see that all the time with, Ross Ulbricht is like a very prominent example. But then
he would still be in jail today if it wasn't for the Bitcoin community rallying behind him. I mean, that's a perfect example.
Yeah. But even like there was I don't know if you saw on Twitter in the last month and a half, a guy lost his seed phrase. He'd been stacking for a long time trying to get to one Bitcoin. And I was fortunate that I kind of got roped in with some other guys. Like, we're going to help him get set up in proper self-custody. He had a ton of people sending him sats, you know.
Amazing.
And it's a unique thing. And I think part of it is the low time preference behavior that Bitcoin just, you know, forces upon you. And then, you know, we're fortunate that the revolution we're a part of is a monetary one. And we are, you know, accumulating wealth, and our wealth is continuing to grow. And we have the opportunity to do that. I saw a meme recently that said something to the effect of, if we sent 6-month-olds to government schools and they taught those kids how to walk, after 2 generations, we would think that without the government, kids would never learn how to walk. And I think that's sort of the paradigm that you're describing here. We're so accustomed to, like when you talk about like helping your neighbor, dropping off, you know, or going and introducing yourself to your neighbor. I think I should drop off ribeyes if I have anyone move nearby me instead of cookies. But you know, it's like, man, if we didn't have the government, we wouldn't be taking care of the, you know, poor people or whoever. It's like, if you give me 25% or 30% of my money back that you steal from me every year, watch what I do with it. Like, I would be more than happy. And you know what? I would do it without the administrative overhead that any government agency is going to have. So, you know, it would be a powerful thing, but we take for granted it wasn't always that way, and it doesn't have to be that way. And we'd be much better off if it wasn't.
I mean, if you look at the just generosity of Americans over the last 50 years, you know, the percentage of income that people actually give away has gone down like this, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like they're stealing our generosity because we're just relying upon the government to take care of it. And I think that is a harmful, unhealthy perspective, you know,
yeah.
With Crowd Health, like it's cool because you get to know, you get to know exactly where your money goes. You know, if Michael Jordan, gets hurt playing basketball, I'm sending you, sorry, I had to just once. It'll be my only reference.
No, you're good.
You know, I get to send money directly to Michael with his, you know, thing. It's, I'm not sending it just to United Healthcare, not having any idea how United Healthcare is going to do that. I'm not sending it to the government and hoping that the government pays for it. Like I'm sending my money directly to Michael, and Michael now has money to go and pay for his, you know, what, his basketball injury. And so, you know, we oftentimes get cases where we send out, the most recurring one we get is like miscarriages. You know, we send out a request to help somebody with a miscarriage, and there's cost associated with that. And, you know, oftentimes the women will come back and be like, man, I know what this family is going through. I've been there. I know the pain that they're feeling. Instead of $100 this month, can I send them $200? And to me, it's like you would never call United Healthcare and be like, can I give you more money this month? Like it just never happens, right? But we're kind of instilling or trying to like reinvigorate the generosity within the community. And that's kind of one of my submissions, is like to reinstill a sense of generosity within people. Cause I know, you know, when my family's been generous or whatever, like, man, that's awesome. That feels good. Like there's joy there when we can help somebody out in a difficult situation. And the fact that, you know, us Bitcoiners have the capital to do that, because our, you know, we're typically not, you know, allowing the fiat monetary system to be a big part of our financial outcome. We have the finances then to go out and help, you know, whereas, you know, with a fiat system, those excess finances are sucked away from you, whether it be through inflation or taxes or whatever it may be. So, you know, give people money and I think they will allocate the money the way that they want to allocate that money, as opposed to what some megacorp or, you know, government wants to allocate that money. And as you said, it becomes way more efficient, and I think it builds community, and I think it alleviates some of this like me versus you behavior that we see within our country right now. You know, I'll give money to somebody on the left just as well as I give somebody on the right. Like if somebody's having a hard, difficult time, as long as it's like not self-inflicted, you know, I don't care, you know, what your political stance is. I'm more than happy to help. So I think we need more of that in our culture. And for some reason, kind of the Bitcoiners and just that low time preference mentality, that self-sovereignty mentality is something that reignites generosity, which I love about the community.
I love that. I think that's also a good segue into Crowd Health. Could you explain how Crowd Health works and maybe sort of juxtapose it with traditional health insurance and maybe even elaborate on why you chose to, you know, have the mechanics in place to make it work the way it does?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Crowd Health, real quick, is we've got about 10,000 people in the community who've all kind of raised their hand to say, hey, if somebody else in the community gets hurt, I'm willing to help. And so, you know, if somebody breaks their arm and it's $5,000, we ask them to come up with the first $500. We want you to have skin in the game. And then we'll send the remaining $4,500 to the community. So just for easy math, let's say we're asking everybody in the community for $100. We'll ask 45 people for that $100. And if they say yes, then money will go from their account to the person who needs help account. And then after 45 people say yes, they'll have $4,500 plus the $500 they're contributing to go and pay for their broken arm or whatever it is. And then the cool part about that is, given that they're paying the doctor directly, these doctors in these facilities don't have to spend the administrative cost of billing health insurance. So, you know, the estimates are somewhere between 30 and 40% of revenue is sucked up with just administrative costs of billing. Whereas if you, you know, write them a check or pay with a credit card, or even better, pay them over Lightning, like those costs are either, you know, next to nothing or a couple percent, right? And so, you know, you're in essence stripping out all that administrative cost, all the rent seekers in between you and your doctor. And as a result, you can get way better prices. So prices for kind of the big events that we're dealing with, that we're helping people pay, are about 50% less than what United Healthcare would pay for the exact same procedure. So you're getting way better prices if you pay the doctor directly, and you know, you have that doctor-patient relationship is reestablished, because doctors currently have to get approval to provide you care from the health insurance plan. But with us, it's between you and your doctor. You guys do what you want to do to for you both to think that, you know, you can get back to being healthy. You get to the core root of the issues. And so, you know, it's just a way better way of doing healthcare. You pay directly for almost everything else in life except for healthcare. You rely upon somebody else to pay it for you. And therefore, that disconnect creates tons of friction and tons of cost. And so we rip that out by enabling you to pay in cash or Bitcoin or whatever when you go to your doctor. So that's kind of the foundation from which we are created, is enable people to pay cash, rip those expenses out. A couple interesting stats. One is, for every doctor, there's somewhere between 2 and 3 billing people behind the scenes that are needed to actually get that doctor paid. The other thing is, a survey just came out, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 months ago, where doctors are spending about 15 and a half hours a week on administrative tasks. Most of that goes to billing health insurance. So imagine you have to, you know, if you have a 5-day week, you have to spend almost 2 of those days just to fight your employer to get paid. Like, that means you're wickedly inefficient during those 2 days, right? So what if we could give those 2 days back to doctors so they can do what they are really good at doing, which is providing care to human beings? You just kind of restore all of that by paying them directly, as opposed to having health insurance in the middle of that. So that's in essence what we're enabling. And you know, that's a little bit of how the mechanics work. I'm happy to fill in any gaps there, but you know, we've done that for somewhere between 20 and 25,000 bills over the last 3 years. And 99.8% of them have gotten fully funded. The 0.2% are people who have asked to get things from the community, but haven't been willing to give to the community. So rewind when I say we asked 45 people, those 45 people have a decision. They can say yes to that funding event or no. And if they say yes, then the money transfers. If they say no, we just move on to the next person. But if that person who said no then asked for money from the community, we tell the community, here's the last 10 times that they've been asked, what have they said? Have they said yes, 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 or have they said no, 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 no? And the people who said no, 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 in essence, not willing to give to other people in the community, the community members see that. And most times, 90% of the time, they're like, man, I'm not going to give to this person. They're not willing to give to others and when they're in need. So there's this kind of reciprocity engine that drives what we do. And again, it's kind of based on generosity. And it's not 100% altruistic, because you know, if you say no to somebody else, then the community will know that you said no to somebody else. And so it incentivizes you to help other people in the community. But those mechanics work, you know, really, really well. And so I said, like, somewhere between 20 and 25,000 bills. And it's everything from like little pediatric visits that are, you know, under $100 to, you know, mega issues. You know, we had a guy in Montana. He was fishing. He was in bear country, wolf country. And so he had a 44 in his holster, and he caught a fish. He leaned down, the gun fell out of his holster, hit perfectly on a rock. It fired, you know, went into his calf, out the back of his calf, into his thigh, out the top of his thigh, into his chest, and out the back. So one bullet, 6 holes. And, you know, that one is hundreds of thousands of dollars, approaching $1 million. And that one's gotten fully funded by the community. So it's, you know, both for the small bills and the big bills.
Wow. That is wild. So I love this model, and it sort of harkens back to what you were talking about. Like, I think shame is an underappreciated value. what you're kind of describing is the way communities have historically worked, right? Like, if you were the town bum and you weren't helping anyone, you didn't share, you didn't pitch in, whatever, like you were ostracized, or people just kind of let you do your own thing. And like, we're not going to be there for you if you're not going to be there for us. And what you're doing is just bringing back like these traditional values to, I mean, to health, health costs. And I think that's an important, I think it's just an important value to have. It's like, make shame great again. And you're right. It's not fully altruistic when you know that you're not going to get covered, but it creates the right incentives. And I think that's important. Like, we rely on each other for certain things. And, unfortunately, we live in a society where because of everything we've talked about before, we rely on each other less and less. I think if we can get back to that and, make shame great again, I think we're all going to benefit. So am I correct in understanding?
Say this, like, if your neighbor, jams all night long and parties until 3 a.m. and keeps you awake, right? And then comes to you the next day asking for, something out of your pantry because they don't have something. What is the probability that you're actually going to give that to that person?
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's a something about, like, we as a community all have to act individually responsible to be a good community. And so, that's where, some of my Bitcoiners are like, oh, well, you guys are all about community and not about personal responsibilities. Like, no. Like, I want to be in community with people who all take personal responsibility. Like, that's who I want to be a part of, right? And so, in essence, that's what we're kind of doing with Crowd Health. Like, look, if one of your Crowd Health members, jams all night long and parties until 3 a.m. and keeps you up, you're probably not going to help them, just using that analogy. But, it's a well-functioning community when everybody is personally responsible and takes care of themselves, but still thinks about the community and their personal actions and how it impacts the people around them. And so that's kind of the fundamental system that we're built on. Like I said, it's worked incredibly well over, a substantial number of bills.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So am I correct in understanding if you have, like, I took my daughter to, she's one, she's had two ear infections in the last month, might need to check into tubes, I don't know. But if I took her to the doctor and, they prescribe an antibiotic or something, and the cost of that visit is $100, am I correct that as a subscriber, I would cover that because it doesn't meet that $500 threshold? Is that right? Like, really what you're being covered for by the community are those more expensive events. Is that right?
Yeah. What we do is we say, you pay the first $500 of any health event. But let's just say your daughter, went to the pediatrician, and had, an ear infection, and then had another one, and then had another one. And then the pediatrician is finally like, look, we need to get tubes in our ears. So you had to have a surgery, and you might have a prescription or something associated with that. That entire set of doctor's visits, prescriptions, surgeries is one health event. And so we ask you to pay the first $500 of that. And then anything above that $500, then we will submit to the community for funding. There's one caveat to that. We want people to go and get, wellness visits every year. My wellness visit just looks like go getting a full set of labs, and Crowd Health will submit up to $300 of any kind of preventative related visit that you have that month. So if you go, if your wife goes to the gynecologist, or your kids go to the pediatrician or the primary care doc, whatever, one of those visits per year up to $300 is eligible for funding. And so that's the one caveat to that 500, because we don't want people to not go to the doctor because they can't afford it. And so that's that. And then the other thing too is we have unlimited amounts of virtual urgent care eligible. So, if you have something that's urgent, there's a virtual urgent care doc link in our app. You just press it, and typically within a couple of minutes you can talk to a doctor. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, your daughter probably has an ear infection. Here's what you need to do. And that's fully fundable by the community, those virtual care visits. And that's served people really, really well.
OK, I love that. So I go on my Crowd Health app and I see you've got settings, so I can auto contribute to green events, which are. Effectively, as I understand it, your team has verified that the cost of the event is based on fair market pricing, and or maybe this has been a generous member. So, like, I want to help generous members. I want to help people who are making prudent decisions about who they engage for health services. So my question, because this is more of a selfish question, I'm just sort of trying to discern how it all works for the red events. Either it's a member who hasn't been sufficiently generous, or perhaps the service didn't meet some threshold for fair market value in terms of the cost. What I'm curious about is, so like if my my son broke his leg, and we're kind of in an urgent situation, right? Like I'm not going to message the crowd health team and say, hey, what doctor should I go to for my son's broken leg? I'm going to get to the closest place. Is that going to be covered regardless, or are you going to negotiate the price? Like how does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what happens with some of these urgent emergency type of situations? You'll typically go to the ER. And those ER, you never pay at the ER. You'll get those bills afterwards. And then what you do is you go into our app, you take a picture of the bill, those upload to us, we'll consolidate them, and then we'll negotiate after the fact on your behalf. So, you know, if you go to X and follow our join Crowd Health, you'll see we usually about once a week, we share like a great, you know, negotiation that we've done. And so we can negotiate on your behalf with that hospital to get that price down. Because typically what the hospital will do is they'll just give you a massive price. And you're like, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do with this? And it's a fake price in essence. And so we've got a team of people who can actually negotiate those bills down for you. And then once we have a negotiated bill, we go back to you and we say, hey, this ER visit was $20,000. We negotiated it down to $5,000. Are you okay with us now going and funding that? And you'll say, yep, go ahead. You'll pay the first $500. We'll go out and fund the remaining $4,500. And so if it's an emergency situation, like you're not calling us on the way to the ER and be like, you know, what ER should we go to? And it's like, no. The only thing that we ask you to do is call us in terms of like some of these big scheduled procedures. So let's just say, you know, you went to the ER. The ER was like, oh yeah, like this one's bad. Like you're going to have surgery to fix this. Then we ask you like, hey, will you call us? Because then we can find you a great orthopedic surgeon wherever you live. And we can pre-negotiate a price as opposed to you just walking in and then giving you some random price. It can be way, way, way too high. And so all we just do is ask like for these big procedures, non-ER, just call us and let us, you know, help you find a really great doc. And if you have a really great doc, that's great. We can call them and we can negotiate the price directly with them. But that's the only thing we ask. And that's where it comes into the, you know, the fair market price. Because if you go and get like a colonoscopy, for example, you're not going to be able to find a colonoscopy under $3,500 or $4,000. Whereas we can find colonoscopies for $1,200. And so it's like, please call us so that we can show you what docs. And the cool thing about this too is now that we have, you know, 10,000 members, these are 10,000 members all over the country who've gone to docs probably in your city, most metropolitan areas. And they've said, man, this doc was great. They had did a great job. The price was reasonable, had a great experience. And so wouldn't you want to go to a doc like that versus a doctor that, you know, the hospital system is going to refer you to, which is probably a part of their hospital system. So they're referring you to somebody else so they get paid more. We can lead you to really great docs. And we've gotten such great feedback from our members who are like, wow, that doc was awesome. So that's the only thing that we help you with. One other thing that you said, I just want to clarify for people listening is we will ask you once per month, sometimes twice, but most of the time once per month to help somebody else out in the community. And you've got 48 hours to decide, do I want to give or do I not want to give? And if you, you know, ignore it, then it automatically triggers a yes, I will give. But you have settings in your app that can say, hey, just anything that's a green bill, which means the member is generous and the bill is reasonable, just say yes automatically. So we're not asking you to engage a ton in the system. You can like set these settings and forget about it, set it and forget it if you want to. Or you can set it to, hey, I want to make a manual entry every month. And you can do that too. So we're just trying to create some settings to make it, you know, not administratively, you know, burdensome on you.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So what are some of the biggest concerns or areas of pushback you all face? Like what, because I'll tell you, I mean, for me, it like, I think my thought was maybe my reluctance initially until I lowered my time preference was, you know, what if I had a, what if my wife had breast cancer, or like we had a catastrophic car accident? You know, the big insurers can pay that out. Now, it's a big question if they will, but they're also sort of, you know, too big to fail kind of organizations. So like that was kind of my concern initially. Eventually I just said enough is enough. Like, I'm just not putting a vote into this system anymore. What is it that you typically hear though, that maybe people are reluctant about?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the big ones, like what you just said, like what happens if something really big happens? I mean, I just described to you one where it's like a bill that's approaching $1 million, and that one got fully paid. And that guy is like our biggest advocate. And you know, this is one where, you know, he's in the middle of nowhere and we had to medevac him out via helicopter because the closest hospital was like 2 hours away. He wouldn't survive. And so, you know, this is a big one. We've also had, I think we're dozens now of cancer cases, and they're the bad ones, the breast cancer, the colon cancer. You know, we've had really non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. You know, we can negotiate these bills down, and these are not nearly as expensive when you're paying directly as opposed to paying with health insurance. I'll give you one example. We had a member with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the hospital said, yeah, you need to be on this drug. And that drug was $40,000 a month. And so we went directly to the manufacturer of this drug, the pharmaceutical company, and said, hey, this person is uninsured. We can pay you direct, you know, how much did this drug be? And, you know, it ended up being like $2,500 a month. So we negotiated from $40,000 a month to $2,500 a month. Like, the number of rent seekers between the providers and the payment are so egregious that you can slash those bills, you know, sometimes 90% plus by just getting rid of all the middlemen and going directly to the service provider, right? And so, you know, we've done this now, you know, thousands of times with some of these big bills, and I think every bill above $1,000 has gotten fully funded, to date. So it has worked. And yeah, sure. When I first started and we had 100 members, was I worried about it? Hell yeah, I was worried about it, you know? But now we, when I see some of these big bills come in, I'm like, all right, we got this. You know, we had a little kid who was born with Down syndrome, and he was in the NICU for a long time. I think it was a couple of months. Then he had to have heart surgery because some of these kids with Down syndrome have heart issues, and he had to get cochlear implants because he can't hear. And so we walked through that with this family, and they're actually going to do a mini documentary testimonial on their process with Crowd Health because it was so great. That they got, you know, all these bills paid for another one that was hundreds of thousands of dollars and got it funded. So, you know, like my family is on it. I just still don't have health insurance. I just have Crowd Health. So I'm eating what I'm cooking, and I'm very, very comfortable that if my family were to have, you know, something really, really big, the community would step up for me.
That's fantastic. All right, let's shift gears here for a minute. I think that was a fantastic overview of Crowd Health, and I think everything you described is exactly why we're talking and why I'm a subscriber. So there is a lot of talk now, a lot of eyes being opened to not only healthcare but just like the health and or maybe lack of healthy lifestyles in our country today. What's your take, if you're willing to share, and we'd have to go overtly political, but just, you know, on the MAHA movement, you know, RFK, some of the things he's talking about. Do you have any particular thoughts on what the implications of this would be? Are you excited? Where's your head at?
Yeah, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, I like RFK. I think is it next week that he's going to actually go to the Senate for confirmation? I know that it moved past the first stage. I think it's somewhere like next Monday or Tuesday where he's going to get, you know, voted on by the entire Senate. I'm more excited about RFK because I know he's a Bitcoiner, you know, and so, you know, I think, was it 2 years ago that he gave a speech at Bitcoin, was it 23? Was it last year?
Well, I think he might have spoken 2 years in a row. I was there this past summer, 2024, when he spoke though.
Okay, yeah, and it was like his was the speech of the entire conference. Like, he clearly got it. he clearly knew that there needs to be decentralization. And so I'm more excited about that. Like anytime the, you know, we look to the government to be our savior, like I'm not like overly optimistic. And so I'm not like wickedly optimistic that this is going to massively change, you know, what we do as a country in terms of health. I think, is it going to be, you know, a step forward? Absolutely. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about looking at some of these vaccines and seeing, you know, let's follow the science and see what they're really doing to us. Because I think, you know, the fact that it was like, what is it, 1 in 1,000 kids or something like that, were autistic, and now it's 1 in 34 or 1 in 36 or something. Like, there's clearly something going on. And, you know, as a dad to kids, like I'm very interested in understanding, you know, what the science is, who's influencing the science, what kind of pharmaceutical companies are, you know, are supporting some of these studies that don't show, you know, some of these, you know, vaccine injuries. And so I'm excited about that. But I think that is probably, you know, a tiny percentage of what, you know, is going on in our country. I have not heard from RFK specifically how we're going to reduce chronic disease. You know, and so I'm not, you know, wickedly optimistic about that. But I think it is a good thing to have the spotlight on our health, because I don't think that has been a substantial, spotlight in the past. It is, you know, let us take care of you as the government, as opposed to you need to get healthy. And so I like the messaging change. I'll wait and see if there's actually like a reasonable change and habits, you know, from our, you know, fellow Americans. But I'm cautiously optimistic.
I think cautious optimism is probably a safe place to be. That's sort of how I feel. What I'm beginning to feel more and more, because I agree, I think RFK seems sincere in his concerns. We've been let down by plenty of politicians. I'm very open to that happening too. It does feel though, like having transparency as to what you're putting into your body, I think makes a lot of sense. And if it takes the government to sort of help with that, and maybe, yeah, reduce some of the pharmaceutical ads and some of the manipulative tactics that these companies take, I think great. It still feels like a Band-Aid on this very complex web of perverse incentives with, you know, from, you know, politicians who own stakes in companies and public companies trying to boost their earnings. I don't see us on that. That's like an economic problem, that not a it's a corruption problem, but it's an economic one in nature, I think, more than it is a health problem. And so hopefully he can shed light on these things. But it's like, you know, they've had labels on cigarettes forever, and you can't run cigarette commercials on TV. And people still smoke. I mean, the rates have declined, I think, but more people are vaping. It's like, are we really winning because less people are smoking? I don't know. If people stop consuming so many seed oils and they start putting beef tallow in things, but it's still a highly processed product, you know, like, I just don't know. So I'm hopeful that maybe we see some positive change. I think at the end of the day, and this is what you keep going back to that I think is so important, nothing changes fundamentally because the government says this is going to change. What matters is I get to decide what I feed my children, and I get to decide how sedentary my lifestyle is. And, you know, like we need to get back to this place of personal responsibility. And I think what you're doing at Crowd Health is recreating those incentives for people. You know, if everyone decided that I'm just going to, you know, let myself go, I don't really care, I'm not going to focus and prioritize my health, well, suddenly Crowd Health is going to look a lot more expensive, and, you know, like the costs of everything are going to go up, and it just doesn't work. Like, I think we're realigning these incentives, but it begins at the individual level, and you got to stop. The government can't be your backstop for everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing that I am optimistic about is I'm hoping that the current administration allows companies like ours to go out and innovate as opposed to overregulate. You know, I think we've gotten here by, you know, a government overreach and regulation, which just stifles innovation, all in the name of consumer protection. You know, and I think it is not consumer protection. I think it's control. I think it's a sense of power that these bureaucrats have over, you know, small innovative companies like ours. So I'm hoping this administration will allow people to go out and start trying to innovate in some of these highly regulated industries, because I think that's the only way that we're going to, bust out of some of these, death spirals of healthcare and the medical industrial complex. So I'm fairly confident on that one, right? I'm excited to see what they do in terms of some of the regulations.
Do you feel hamstrung in certain ways? Like, I don't really understand the regulatory landscape in this industry. Is there anything in particular that you're like, if only we could?
Yeah,
but you got to be careful.
It's a good question. I mean, I'll give you one like very tactical thing. I want our Bitcoiners to talk to a doc who is a Bitcoiner, who's got the same worldview as a Bitcoiner. And so what I'd like to do is have to hire one doc who can see any Bitcoiner anywhere they are in the entire country. But you can't do that because doctors have to be approved. They have to be licensed in each state in which they operate. So if there's a doctor in Texas, they can't see somebody in Wyoming or whatever because they're not licensed in Wyoming. And the last time I checked is a person in Texas and a person in Wyoming are the same, physiological makeup, right? It doesn't matter. And so, if I want a Bitcoin doc to be able to see all of my members who are Bitcoiners, they have to go and get licensed in every single state that I have a Bitcoiner. And that is hundreds of thousands of dollars to go and do that. Like it becomes financially unfeasible. And so it's things like that that are just stupid regulatory things that I'm like, let's just rip that out, right? Because right now, if I want to do that, I have to find a Bitcoin doc in each state that can see my Bitcoiner in that state. And that just, I don't have the scale to do that, right? Like I've got, like 1,500 people in Texas, but I've got 5 people in Rhode Island. Like I can't, hire a doctor in Rhode Island to see 5 people. Like I just can't do it. And so it's some of these stupid regulatory things that make no sense that they need to get rid of to help people, innovate and get better care. If there's a great doctor in Idaho that I want to see, I should be able to see that doctor, even though he's not licensed in Texas where I live. So, it's those types of things that I hope they can, get rid of.
Yeah, man, we do not hate the nanny state enough. That's for sure. It's insane. I mean, all the credentialism and certification. I mean, I remember my barber it took him forever to go through to be able to use a straight razor because of all the, it's total nonsense. It's like, let me decide if I want to trust that guy with a straight razor. It's insanity. Well, hey, we're
the government. Yeah. We're here to help. We're here to help you.
Yeah. Yeah. The famous words of Ronald Reagan. But hey, man, we're at the top of the hour. I got one more question for you. This is a fun one I ask at the end to everyone. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with your answer?
Man, you want me to offend people right here at the end? I'm going to take the easy route because it's what we've been talking about. I just think there's a psyop in our society where you have to have health insurance. And I would just say, you don't need health insurance. The vast majority of the population, you do not need health insurance. There is a different way. And if you're a Bitcoin out there and you're fed up with our system, fed up with the healthcare system, come join us because we're trying to create scale, of Bitcoiners. Because ultimately what I want to do is, and we've got the system set up already, is to have, Bitcoin circularity within the healthcare system. This is a $5 trillion system. If we can have Bitcoin be the standard of, payment within healthcare, I mean, I think that goes to a long way to hyper Bitcoinization. And so, I would just say, if you're a Bitcoiner and you want to support Bitcoin companies, we are truly trying to get a group of Bitcoiners together that can change healthcare. And I think we can do it. So, if you're in that decision process, we'd love for y'all to join us.
I love it. Andy, hey, why don't you give everyone a handoff, tell them where they can find you, learn more about CrowdHealth and anything else you want to share?
Yeah. Joincrowdhealth.com is where you'll find us. And if you go on X, X, Instagram, all the social media platforms, we're at Join CrowdHealth. We are about to, in the next couple of weeks, do our quarterly quarter cow contest, which means we give a quarter of a cow to somebody, a a random person who follows us on Instagram, or excuse me, on any of our social media platforms. So if you are interested in winning a quarter cow delivered directly to your door, grass-fed, grass-finished, you know, good stuff, then join us on our social media accounts. Join Crowd Health.
Oh man, I'll be doing that. That's my diet right there. Well, Andy, man, thank you so much for your time. I get to sit here and talk to you all day, and learned a lot. Appreciate everything you're doing. Keep up the good work. This is so important. And for everyone listening, do check out Crowd Health. I'm still a new enough user. I can't speak to the user experience specifically, but I love the concept, and I'm excited to be finished with health insurance for good. So thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Let's do it again.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Andy. Go check out Crowd Health. Check out everything they're doing. I absolutely love this concept. Would encourage you to consider, do you really need traditional health insurance, especially in light of the fact that they might not cover you when you need it? Really appreciate everything Andy is doing. Of course, if you need help with Bitcoin in proper self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We would love to walk you through with one-on-one expertise. We also help with online privacy, privacy phones, and we have a Plan B residency option. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can also check us out on X. We're at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me there as well at @theothermjordan. If you've enjoyed this video or any of our other podcasts, whether our Bitcoin Banter or the Bitcoin Way podcast, do me a huge favor. Subscribe to the channel. Give us a like, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested. Really appreciate you doing that. As always, remember, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.